Several years ago, one of America's premier educational institutions, Harvard Business School, was given a $20 million grant to establish a chair on ethics. Sounds like great news, doesn't it? After all, the ethical crisis of the 80s, the savings and loan fiasco, Wall Street inside trading, political scandals on Capitol Hill, all of it had made many Americans wake up to the fact that professional ethics and common decency just weren't so common anymore. So Chuck Colson, for one, was glad when he heard of Harvard's renewed interest in ethics. But then disturbing reports started coming back. A businessman who took one of Harvard's ethics classes reported that it was simply a course in practical pointers. If you're considering a business move, he was told, think about how it will look if it hits the newspapers. That should tell you whether to do it or not. Chuck Colson wrote an article about Harvard, contending that perhaps it was, after all, impossible for Harvard to teach ethics. Real ethics are based on a foundational understanding of right and wrong, and Harvard had abandoned a belief system based on absolute truth. Harvard's philosophical relativism precluded the teaching of real ethics, he wrote. No wonder the best they could offer was a course in pragmatics. Soon after, Chuck received a letter from Harvard Business School, inviting him to be part of Harvard's Distinguished Lecturer Series to discuss in greater depth the problem of ethics. It was a great challenge. Chuck accepted. But he expected the worst. After all, though he had spoken in plenty of tough situations, in a prison still simmering after an inmate riot, giving speeches on criminal justice reform before hostile state legislatures, even shouting over the noise of professional athletes in their locker room, he expected this Harvard crowd to be particularly tough. Chuck had read that some years earlier, Sir John Eccles, the noted neurobiologist and Nobel Prize winner, had lectured at a full hall at Harvard. He had said he could account for the intricacy of the human brain through evolution, but then it added that human consciousness could be accounted for only by the existence of a transcendent power. For that, Eccles was booed and hissed. Chuck expected the same. He arrived on campus on April 4, 1991, and made his way to Harvard's Aldrich Hall, where he had been assigned the largest lecture room. The room was filled to capacity, with students sitting on the floor and lined up along the walls. Listen now while Chuck speaks to those Harvard students. And stay tuned for the question and answer session, for it was during that period that Chuck learned the most important lesson of his visit to Harvard.
One of the things that I discover in a very civil setting like this that is very nice about it is the fact that they tell you in advance when you're being taped. That will date you. Those of you who laughed are now dated. I think Harvard well deserves the reputation that it enjoys of being a very liberal university. Liberal in the best sense of that word, because you would have as a lecturer in the university today someone who's an ex-convict. But that maybe is not so inappropriate after all, as you look at what's happening on Wall Street and in the business community. Perhaps in the business course here at the business school, they should take a little bit of attention to what is happening in prisons. I just spent 3 hours last week with one of your distinguished alumni who's headed off for 4 years of free room and board, courtesy of the United States government, as I did. I must also say that Harvard deserves the reputation for being a liberal university in the best sense of the word, for inviting me to speak, because for the last 3 or 4 years, I have written articles that here at Harvard could be considered quite impertinent, in which I have described my views, at least, on why it is impossible to teach ethics at Harvard. And I may touch upon that briefly today, and hope you'll all accept it in good spirit, and I'll be prepared for your questions. I'm no longer in politics. I've done my time, literally and figuratively, but it's awfully hard not to watch what is happening in the political scene with a certain sense of dismay when we see the Keating Five, as you've read about, five United States senators tried, in effect, by their own tribunal. Just before that, another senator, happens to be a good friend of mine, Dave Durenberger, who was censured by the Senate. I spent some time recently with Mayor Barry, former Mayor Barry of the District of Columbia, who was, of course, arrested for drug use. You look at South Carolina and Arizona, and you see scams going on in the legislatures that have been now exposed by federal prosecutors. And I saw a press release in which the Department of Justice boasted last year that they had prosecuted and convicted 1,150 public officials, the highest number in the history of the Republic. They were boasting about it. I read it with a certain sadness, because it seems that that kind of corruption has become epidemic in American politics. We see congressmen one after another, Quaylo, Wright, Frank, Lukens, both sides of the aisle, either being censured or forced out of office. We see probably the most cynical of all was the HUD scandal, where people were ripping off money from the public treasury that was designed to help the poor. And then we've seen more spy scandals in the past 5 years than in all previous 195 years of American history combined. People selling their national honor for sexual favors or for money. Business is not immune. The savings and loan scandals, bad enough on the face of them, but the fact that they're so widespread, almost a looter's mentality. Mr. Milken, Mr. Boesky, who spoke at UCLA Business School 5 years ago and said greed is a good thing, and ended up spending 3 years in a federal prison. Just last week, one of the major pharmaceutical firms fined $10 million for covering up violating criminal statutes. Affects athletics. If you pick up the newspapers this week, you saw that Sugar Ray Leonard was just admitted drug use, been a role model for lots of kids on the street. Pete Rose, who spent time in prison for gambling. Academia. I don't know how many of you saw the Stanford University President Kennedy charged with spending $7,000 to buy a pair of sheets. They must be awfully nice bed sheets, bed linens. And charging it to the government improperly on government contracts. And a Nobel Prize winner one day was exposed for presenting a fraudulent paper. And the very next day, a professor at Georgetown University was charged with filing a fraudulent application for a grant from the federal government, from the National Institute of Health. This all in the matter of the past 2 weeks. And probably saddest of all, at least from my perspective, religious leaders. Jim Baker, whom I've also visited in prison, Jimmy Swaggart, prosecuted for violating what should be the most sacred trust of all, to speak for God and to minister to people in their spiritual needs. Well, the first question that comes to mind is whether this is simply an example of people, rotten apples, maybe better prosecution, or maybe you can dismiss this as simply saying, well, this is simply the nature of humanity. I think it was Bishop Fulton Sheehan quoting G.K. Chesterton, or paraphrasing G.K. Chesterton, who once said that the doctrine of original sin is the only philosophy empirically validated by 3,500 years of human history. And so maybe you sort of dismiss this and say, well, this is just the way people are. Or is there something of a pattern here, is the question that I would pose to you today. Time magazine, doing a cover story on ethics recently, said, what's wrong? Hypocrisy, betrayal, and greed unsettle a nation's soul. The Washington Post said that the problem has reached the point where common decency can no longer be described as common. And the New Republic magazine said there is a destructive sense that nothing is true and everything is permitted. Now, I would submit to you that when the Washington Post, New Republic magazine, and Time magazine, which have never been known as bastions of conservative biblical morality, begin to talk about some sort of ethical malaise, that a line has been crossed and that this isn't simply isolated instances, but rather there is a pattern emerging in American life. No institution has been more sensitive to that than Harvard. President Bach has given some quite extraordinary speeches talking about decrying the loss of ethics in the American business community. And business school students, I think maybe some of you have seen the recent polls, business school students across America, by 2-1, believe that businesses are generally unethical. It's a very fragile consensus that holds together trust in our institutions. And when 2-1 business school students believe they're entering into unethical operations, you begin to have to wonder if something isn't affecting us a lot more broadly than simply isolated instances of misbehavior that have been exposed. In my view, I believe we are experiencing in our country today what I choose to call a crisis of character. A loss of what traditionally through Western civilization have been considered those inner restraints and inner virtues that prevent us from pandering to our own darker instincts. If you look back through the history of Harvard, you'll see that President Eliot was as concerned about the development of character as he was about education. And classically, education. Plato once said, if you ask why we should educate someone, we educate them so that they become a good person because good persons behave nobly. And so I come to a place today where we should be deeply concerned about the loss of what Edmund Burke might have called the traditional values of Republican citizenship, words that will almost sound quaint when uttered in these surroundings. Words like valor, honor, duty, responsibility, compassion, civility. Words which have almost fallen into disuse. Well, why has this happened? I'm sure many of you studied philosophy in your undergraduate courses, and if so, you are well aware that through 23 centuries of Western civilization, we were guided by a consensus, a shared set of assumptions, that there was a transcendent value system, not always the Judeo-Christian value system, though I think the Judeo-Christian values were, as Christopher Dawson, the eminent historian, wrote, sort of the heart and soul of Western civilization, but it goes back to the Greeks. It goes back to Plato, saying that if there were no God, there could be no concord and justice and harmony in a society. And there is a strain all through the 23 centuries of the civilization, of the history of the West, a strain of belief in a transcendent value system. Whether it was the unknown God of the Greeks, whether it was the Christ of the Scriptures revealed to the Christian, whether it was the Yahweh of the Old Testament revealed to the Jew, or whether it was, as Enlightenment thinkers chose to call it, natural law, which I believe to be not inconsistent with Judeo-Christian revelation. Nonetheless, that guided our conduct for 23 centuries until a great cultural revolution began in America. A great cultural revolution took place in our country in the 1960s. Some think it goes back further. One eminent historian, Paul Johnson, who happens to be one of my favorites, Paul Johnson wrote the history of Christianity, the history of the Jews. He wrote a classic book called Modern Times. If you're not too busy with your business school studies, it's a wonderful history of the 20th century. Paul Johnson said all of this began in 1919 when Einstein's discovery of relativity in the field of physical sciences was confused with the notion of relativism in the field of ideas. And that gradually through the 20s and 30s, people began to challenge what had been sort of fixed assumptions by which people lived, a set of fixed and shared common values. In the 60s, it exploded. If any of you here were in campuses or on campuses in the 60s, you will well remember that the writings of Camus and Sartre invaded American campuses. And basically what they said was exactly what Camus said when he came to America and spoke at Columbia University in 1947, and to the student body assembled said, "There is nothing." The idea was introduced that there is no God, God is dead, it was on the cover of Time magazine. There is no transcendent value. Life is utterly meaningless, and the only way that we can derive meaning out of life is if we overcome the nothingness of life with heroic individualism, and the goal of life is to overcome that nothingness and to find personal peace and meaning through your own autonomous efforts. And most of the people of my generation dismissed what was happening on the campuses as a passing fad protest in the 60s. It was not. The only people who behaved logically in the 60s were the flower children. They did exactly what they were taught. If there's no other object in life than to overcome the nothingness, then go out and sniff coke or smoke pot and make love and enjoy personal peace. Then America came through the great convulsion of Watergate and Vietnam, a dark era, and into the 70s. And we thought we shook off those protest movements of the 60s. We did not. We simply embraced them into the mainstream of American culture. That's what gave rise to the Me Decade. That's why, if you look at the bestsellers of the 70s, it's very revealing. The best-selling books of the 70s were Winning Through Intimidation, Look Out for Number One, I'm Okay, You're Okay, which is saying, don't worry about we. And we emerged into a decade that Tom Wolfe, the social critic, called the Decade of Me. And very logically, that graduated into the 80s, into what some have cynically called the Golden Age of Greed. There's a professor at the University of California by the name of Robert Bella, who wrote a book, a takeoff on the title from Tocqueville's classic work of American Life, entitled Habits of the Heart. And Robert Bella took a couple of hundred average middle-class Americans and tried to examine really what their values were. And he came to the conclusion that the reigning ethos in American life in the 80s, was what he called ontological individualism, radical individualism, the idea that the individual is supreme and autonomous, lives for himself or herself. And he found that Americans had two overriding goals, vivid personal feelings and personal success. He tried to find out what people expected from the institutions of society. From business, they expected personal advancement. Okay, that's fair enough. From marriage, personal development. No wonder marriages are in trouble. And from church, personal fulfillment. But the personal became the dominant consideration. Now, I would simply say to you today, and I'll try to be as brief about with this as I possibly can, I would simply say to you that this self-obsession destroys character. Has to. All those quaint-sounding virtues I talked about that historically have been considered the elements of character are no match for a society in which the exaltation and gratification of self becomes the overriding goal of life. Rolling Stone magazine did a survey of the baby boom generation, of which many of you in this room are baby boomers, emerging leaders. 40% said there was no cause for which they would fight for their country. If there's nothing worth dying for, there's nothing worth living for. Literally, the social contract unravels when that happens. And there can be no ethics. How can you have ethical behavior? The crisis of character is totally understandable when there are no absolute values. The word ethics derives from the Greek word ethos, and ethos literally meant a cave, a hiding place. It was the one place you could go and find security. There could be rest. There could be something there that you could depend upon. It was unmovable. Morals derives from the word mores, which is always changing. Ethics, or ethos, is the normative. That is what ought to be. Morals is what is. And unfortunately, in American life today, we are totally guided by moral determinations. So we're never even looking at ethical standards. Ethical standards don't change. It's the cave. It's the ethos. It's the environment in which we live. Morals change all the time. And so with shifting morals, if 90% of the people say that it's perfectly all right to do this, well, then that must be perfectly all right to do it, because 90% of the people say it. It's a very democratic notion. Ethics is not, cannot be democratic. Ethics, by its very definition, is authoritarian. And that's a very nasty word to utter on any campus in America, particularly at Harvard, where Arthur Schlesinger has written a magnificently argued assault on the perils of absolutism, and I'll refer to that in just a moment. In a relativistic environment, ethics deteriorates to nothing more than utilitarian or pragmatic consideration. And if you're really honest with yourselves and you look at the ethical questions that you're asked to wrestle with in your courses here in Harvard, you will see that what you are being taught is how you can arrive at certain conclusions yourself and make certain judgments yourself that ultimately are going to be good for the business. And that's fine. You should do that. That's a prudential decision that has to be made, and that's being a responsible business leader. It just isn't ethics, and shouldn't be confused with ethics. Ethics is the what ought to be, not what is or even is prudential. There's a brilliant professor at Duke, Stanley Hauerwas, who writes that moral life cannot be found by each person pursuing his or her options. In relativism, all you have then are a set of options. The only way moral life can be produced is by the formation of virtuous people by tradition-formed communities. And that was the accepted wisdom of 23 centuries of Western civilization until the Cultural Revolution of the 60s, with which we are still plagued. Well, what is the answer? I'd like to address two points today. First, how each of us individually might view our own ethical framework. And then why some set of transcendent values. We live in a pluralistic environment, pluralistic society. I happen to be a Baptist. I believe strongly in a pluralistic environment, and that I should be able to contend for my values, you should be able to contend for your values, and out of that contention comes some consensus that we can all agree to live by. That's the beauty of pluralism. It doesn't mean extinguishing all ideas, it means contending for them and finding truth. Out of that consensus, out of that battle, comes some consensus by which people live. But I would argue that there must be some values, and I would take the liberty of arguing for my belief in a certain set of historic values being absolutely essential for the survival of society. But first, let me just go to the question of how we find it ourselves. And I know if you studied on your philosophy courses as an undergraduate, you read about Immanuel Kant and the categorical imperative, you read about rationalism, you read about the ways in which people can find their own ethical framework. I guess the only thing I can tell you, having tried that, is that in my life, and I can't speak for anyone else, it didn't work. I grew up in America during the Great Depression and thought that the great goal of life was success and material gain and power and influence. That's why I went into politics. I believed I could gain power and influence how people lived. And that if I earned a law degree as I did at night, and if I had academic honors and awards, that would enable me to find success and power and fulfillment and meaning in life. I had a great respect for the law. When I went through law school, I had a love for the law. I learned really the history of jurisprudence and the philosophy underlying it. I'd studied Locke and the Enlightenment social contract theories as an undergraduate at Brown. I had a great respect for the political process. I also had a well above average IQ and some academic honors. I also became very self-righteous. When I went to the White House, I gave up a law practice that was making almost $200,000 a year, and that was back in 1969, which wasn't bad in those days. It's kind of ordinary now for graduates of Harvard Business School, but then it was a lot of money. And I had accumulated a little bit of money and took a job in the White House at $40,000 a year, and so I took everything I had and I stuck it in a blind trust at the Bank of Boston. Now, let me tell you, if you want to lose money, that's the surest way to do it. After 3.5 years, when I saw what the Bank of Boston had done to my blind trust, I realized I was a lot poorer when I come out of the government than I was when I went into the government. But there was one thing about it. I was absolutely certain that no one could corrupt me. Positive. And if anybody ever gave me a present at Christmas time, it went right to the driver of my limousine. People used to send in bottles of whiskey and boxes of candy and all sorts of things. Right to the driver of my automobile. I wouldn't accept a thing. Patty and I were taken out on someone's boat one day. I discovered it was a chartered boat. Ended up paying for half of it because no one, Tom Phillips, my blessed friend who's with me today, I'd been counsel for Raytheon before going to the White House, so I wouldn't see anybody from Raytheon because I didn't want to give the appearance of impropriety. Imagine we worried about things like that. I ended up going to prison. So much for the categorical imperative. Categorical imperative says that with our own rational process, we will arrive at that judgment which, if everyone did it, would be prudential, would be the best decision for everyone. In other words, that which we would do only if we could will it to be a universal choice for everybody. I really thought that way, and I never once in my life thought I was breaking the law. I've been terrified to do it because I would jeopardize the law degree. I'd worked 4 years at night and worked my way onto the law review and order of coif and moot court and all the things that lawyers do, and I graduated in the top of my class. I wouldn't put that in jeopardy for anything in the world. I was so sure. But you see, there's two problems. Every human being has an infinite capacity for self-rationalization and self-delusion. You get caught up in a situation where you're absolutely convinced that the fate of the Republic rests on the re-election of, in my case, Richard Nixon, and I'm sure next year people will think the same thing about George Bush. And there's an enormous amount of peer pressure, and you don't take time to stop and think, wait a minute, is this right by some absolute standard, or does this seem right in the circumstances? Is it okay? I was taught to think clearly and carefully. As a lawyer, that's what you do. You brief cases. You spend 4 years in law school. You're like a monkey. You're briefing cases. Briefing cases. We use the case method as you use the case method here in business. And the case method in law school, however, is a little bit different because you always have a fixed conclusion. So at least I knew there was a fixed law that you would arrive at. I had all the mental capacity to do that. I was capable of infinite self-delusion. But secondly, and even more importantly, and this goes to the heart of the ethical dilemma in America today, even if I had known I was doing wrong, would I have the will to do what is right? And it isn't hindsight. I have to tell you the answer to that is no. The greatest myth of the 20th century is that people are good. We aren't. We're not morally neutral. My great friend Professor Samenow happens to be an Orthodox Jew. I asked him one day, I said, Stan, if people were put in a room and that no one could see what they were doing and no one knew what they were doing, would they do the right thing half the time and the wrong thing half the time? Would they do the wrong thing all the time? Would they do the right thing all the time? He said they would always do the wrong thing. We aren't morally neutral. I know that's a terribly unpopular thing to say in America today, but it happens to be true. And the fundamental problem with learning how to reason through ethical solution is it doesn't give you a mechanism whereby your natural tendency to do what is wrong is overridden. There's nothing that makes your will. This is what C.S. Lewis, who had such a profound, his writings had such a profound influence on my life. Tom Phillips gave me the book, Mere Christianity, when I came to him in the summer of 1973 in a moment of great anguish in my life because I wasn't so worried about what was going on in the Watergate, but I knew what was going on in my heart I didn't like. And so I went to see him and visited him one evening. Something different about him. I went, and that was the evening that, if you've read it, any of you know my story, that ex-Marine captain, White House tough guy, the Nixon hatchet man, and all kinds of things you can't write about in print or wouldn't say in polite company, that I was called in those days, much of it justifiably. I found myself, when I left his home that night after he had told me of his experience with Jesus Christ, I found myself unable to drive the automobile out of the driveway. I was crying to it. And I took that little book he'd given me, Mere Christianity, and began to read that and study it as I studied for a case. I'd take my yellow sheets. I still use them. Yellow legal pads. Get down with all the arguments, both sides, and I was confronted with the most powerful mind I'd been exposed to and saw the arguments for the truth of Jesus Christ and surrendered my life 18 years ago. My life has not been the same since, can never be the same again. But I discovered something, that Christ coming into your life changes that will. It gives you that will to do what you know is right, where even if you know what is right, and most of the time you won't, you don't have the will to do it. So C.S. Lewis wrote in that tremendous little book, Abolition of Man. I'd love you to read Mere Christianity, but if you had to read just Mere Christianity or Abolition of Man for today's cultural environment, read Abolition of Man. Wonderful book. This is not, I don't know how to say this in language that is inclusive, but he wrote a marvelous essay called Men Without Chests. I can't say men and women without chests. I can say persons without chests, I guess. But it's a wonderful article about the will. And he said the passions of the stomach can't control, the intellect can't control the passions of the stomach except by means of the will, which is the chest. And that we make geldings and then bid them to multiply. We mock honor and then we are alarmed when there are traitors in our midst. And he was talking about the loss of character. And he was talking about it in 1947, 1948, long before we have seen the results of what the loss of character means in American life today. Well, so much for the individual. What about society as a whole? Margaret Thatcher gave what I consider to be one of those remarkable speeches. You'll only find it reprinted in the Wall Street Journal. One of the most remarkable speeches has been given in modern times. It was given 2.5 years ago before the Church of Scotland. And what Margaret Thatcher said basically is, and I'll paraphrase what was marvelous, eloquent speech. What Margaret Thatcher said is that the truths of the Judeo-Christian tradition is infinitely precious, not only because she said, I believe it to be true, and she professed her own faith, but she said it provides the moral impulse that causes people to rise above themselves and do something greater than themselves without which a democracy cannot survive. And she goes on to make the case, I think quite convincing, that without Judeo-Christian values at the root of society, society simply can't exist. Our founders believe this. All of our founders said this. We were not formed as a totally tolerant, neutral, egalitarian democracy. We were formed as a republic with a certain sense of republican virtue built into the citizenry without which limited government simply couldn't survive. No one said it better than John Adams. But there are four ways in which that moral impulse works. Someone sent me, a letter with a suggested topic for this speech, and the speech was why good people do bad things. And I didn't have time to write back and say I really think that it would be a more appropriate thing to say why bad people do good things, because that's a more difficult question. Why do we do good things? I mean, if we live in an age of ontological individualism, if radical individualism is the pervasive ethos of the day, if we simply live for the gratification of our senses, of our personal success, and vivid personal feelings, why do anything good? Who cares? I'm going to make a particle of difference. Unless it's important to your balance sheet, but that's pragmatism. That isn't doing good things. That's pure utilitarianism. And we do good things because there is something in us that calls us to something greater than ourselves. I work in a ministry in prisons. Not a very glamorous place to be. I was just in prison this weekend in three prisons. I was so moved in one prison because there were 600 inmates that came out and saw their lives changed. And those are people who were lost, forgotten. And also saw the 50 volunteers who go in there regularly. And one man stood up and he said, 10 years ago I was in this prison and one of your volunteers came in, Mr. Colson, and they befriended me, this couple from Akron, Ohio. And he said, you know, they've been visiting me every month and writing to me ever since for 10 years. And he said, I get out of prison in September and they've invited me to live in their home. He said, I'm going to make it. Why do people do that? Why do you go to the AIDS wards? One of my friends goes into the AIDS wards all the time and in prison and people die in his arms. I mean, do we do it because we have some good instinct? No. There's a moral impulse. Why did William Wilberforce stand up on the floor of the Parliament in the House of Commons and denounce the slave trade because he said it was barbaric and he cost himself the Prime Ministership of England when he did it? But he said, my conscience is held captive to the revelation of God. I have no choice as a Christian. And he spent the next 20 years battling the slave trade and brought to an end the slave trade in England because of his Christian conscience. What informs our conscience? What is it that makes us, as otherwise self-centered people, disposed, if my friend Stan Samenow in the history of the 20th century and the history of civilization is correct, if we're disposed to evil, what is it that makes us do good? Secondly, I don't believe, I think Margaret Thatcher is absolutely right, I do not believe that a society can survive, and I tell you this as one who sat next to the President of the United States and saw the moral consensus which kind of holds our country together during Vietnam, just fragile. I mean, we were really, we did some excessive things, but we did it in, and we were wrong, but we did it in a feeling that if we didn't, the whole country was going to fall apart. It was like a banana republic, having an 82nd Airborne down in the basement of the White House, and my car one night was firebombed on the way, I mean, it threw a firebomb under my car on the way home. It had 250,000 protesters in the streets and the smell of tear gas and buses, and you almost wondered if the White House was going to be overrun. And the moral consensus which holds the country together was in great peril during that era and during the entire Watergate aftermath of Vietnam. A society, just a free society, can't exist without it. Now, what gives it to us? Aquinas wrote that without consensus, without moral consensus, there can be no law. Chairman Mao gave the other side of that. Chairman Mao said morality begins at the muzzle of a gun. And every society has two choices, and that is whether it wants to be ruled by an authoritarian ruler or whether there can be a set of shared values, whether people can say there are certain things we hold in common and we hold dear, and they give us the philosophical underpinnings of our value system in our life. And I submit to you that without that, call it natural law if you wish, call it Judeo-Christian revelation, call it the accumulated wisdom of 23 centuries of Western civilization. But without that, I don't believe a society can exist. The reason we have the most terrible crime problem in the world, in America today, simple reason. We've lost our moral consensus. We're people living in the house. You know, we have doubled the prison population in America in the 1980s. We are today number one in the rate of incarceration per capita in the world. When I started this ministry 15 years ago, we were number three. We trailed the Soviet Union and South Africa. Today, we're number one. And the more prisons we build and the more people we put in, the recidivism rate remains constant at 75%. Those people come right back out. And the answer to it is very simple. There are kids being raised today from broken families who are not being given. Remember what I said, Stanley Hauerwas said, the way you treat ethics is from tradition-formed communities. They're not being given values in the home. They're not being given values in the school. They're watching the television set for 7 hours and 36 minutes a day. And what they're seeing is you only go around this way once, so grab for all the gusto while you can. If that's the creed by which you live, then at 12 years old, they're out in the street sniffing coke. We arrest them, put them in jail. They think we're crazy, so do I. Until you have some desire in the society to live by a different set of values, we'll be building prisons in America until, as is the case today, 25% of the black inner city population in America is either in prison or on probation or parole. Can't make it without that moral consensus. It will cost us dearly if we can't find a way to restore it. Professor Wilson, James Wilson at the Harvard Law School, wrote one of the most telling pieces I've ever read. And I refer to it in one of my books, Kingdoms in Conflict, if you care to look at it, to find the resource for it. He wrote a little primer while he was here at Harvard. He's no longer at Harvard. About the relationship between spiritual values and crime. It was really interesting. Crime, the prevailing myth is that it goes up during periods of poverty. It actually went down in the 30s. And he found during periods of industrialization it went up as what he called Victorian values began to fade. And when there was a resurgence of spiritual values, crime went down. He saw a direct correlation. Crime was going up. Whenever spiritual values were declining, whenever spiritual values were going up, crime was going down. It's a lack of a moral consensus. Third, so often I think we miss the basis of sound policy because we have become so secularized in our views in America, so afraid to look at biblical revelation. I mean, we're terrified of it. I mean, when Ted Koppel gave that speech at Duke commencement a few years ago in which he said the Ten Commandments weren't the Ten Suggestions, God handed commandments to Moses at Mount Sinai. And you remember what the press did to him. I mean, this was horrible. A fellow like Ted Koppel couldn't possibly say something like this. So we blind ourselves to what can often be truth. I mean, I've been invited to, have spoken in over half the state legislatures in America. Just met with the governor of Ohio last Friday, lieutenant governor of Ohio, and talked to the governor of Ohio on many occasions. Been with many of the political leaders around this country, and I always make the same argument to them about our prisons. We have many too many people in prison. We half the prison population are there for nonviolent offenses. And to me, it's ludicrous. They should be put to work. I mean, people should not be sitting in a cell at a cost of $20,000 a year to us taxpayers while doing absolutely nothing, and their victims getting no recompense. That offender ought to be out, put in a work program, paying back their victims. And whenever I speak about that, it's amazing the response I get from political officials. It really is. Any legislature, the same thing will happen. It happened in Texas very dramatically. I gave that talk, and they all applauded. Afterwards, the Speaker of the House said, Mr. Colson, wait here. I'm sure some of the members would like to come and talk to you. And they came flooding in afterwards. And one after another, they come in and say, that restitution, that's a wonderful idea. Where did that come from? I said, have you got a Bible at home? Oh, you got a Bible at home. I said, well, you go home and dust it off, and you'll see that's exactly what God told Moses at Mount Sinai. I mean, that's biblical truth. That's the lesson of Jesus and Zacchaeus. But we blind ourselves to it because we think there's something wrong with that in today's tolerant society. In a pluralistic society, it ought not to be wrong. We ought to be seeking that out. If we can find wisdom, find it. And so often we find wisdom in the teachings of the Holy Scripture. And fourth, no society exists in a vacuum. Vacuums don't remain vacuums. They get filled. And in a vacuum, a tyrant will often emerge. We've just seen 70 years of that crumbling in the East. But isn't it interesting that when it crumbles, it is so often crumbles because people have an allegiance to a power above the power of that earthly potentate. I remember when the Pope said that he would return to Poland if the Soviets invaded. And Stalin said, ha, the Pope, how many divisions does he have? Well, as a result of the Solidarity Movement, we saw how many divisions he had. A whole lot more than the Soviets. I remember getting on an airplane coming up here to Boston to see our first grandson when he was born, and so I therefore can date it, back in 1981. And a man got up out of the aisle of the plane, and he was all excited to see me. He said, Chuck Colson! And he was blocking the people coming behind me, so I finally got him into his seat. He looked Oriental. I didn't know his background, and he was talking so fast I couldn't understand him. And to make a long story short, he introduced himself as Benigno Aquino. And Aquino told me that when he was in jail for 7 years and 7 months, a political prisoner of Marcos, that he had read my book, Born Again. And that one night on a prison cell, he'd gotten down on his knees and surrendered his life to Jesus Christ. And he said after that, his entire experience in prison changed. Well, Nino and I became pretty good friends. We did some television programs together, and we visited frequently. And he called me up one day, and he said, I'm going back to the Philippines. I said, Nino, do you think that's wise? He said, I have to. He said, I'm going back because my conscience will not let me do otherwise. He was safe here in America. He had a fellowship here at Harvard. He could lecture anywhere he wanted. Lived with his wife here in Newton. They had everything they could possibly want. But he knew he had to go back to the Philippines. My conscience will let me do otherwise. He said, if I go to jail, it's okay. I'll be president of prison fellowship in the Philippines. He said, if there are free elections, I'll be elected president. I know I can beat Marcos. And if I'm killed, I know I'll be with Jesus Christ. Man went back with total freedom. He never got off the plane, as you know. He was shot and killed. But an extraordinary thing happened. What's known as people power. People went out in the streets. The tanks stopped. People went up and put flowers down the muzzles of guns. and a tyrant was overthrown, and a free government was reasserted. Because people believed in a power above themselves. I was in the Soviet Union last year, visited five prisons, four of which had never been visited by anyone from the West. That was Soviet officials. It's really interesting. I met with Vadim Viktorovich Pakhatin, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, who's since been sacked because he was too liberal. And when talking about the enormous crime problem in the Soviet Union, and he said to me, what are we going to do about it? I said, Mr. Pakhatin, your problem is exactly the one that Fyodor Dostoevsky, your great novelist, diagnosed. When in Brothers Karamazov, he had, you remember those of you who read it, that wonderful debate between the older brother, who's unregenerate, and the younger brother, Alexei, who's the priest, over the soul of the middle brother, Ivan. And at one point, Ivan yells out and he says, ah, if there is no God, everything is permissible. Crime becomes inevitable. I said, your problem in the Soviet Union is 70 years of atheism. He said, you're right. We need what you've got. How do we get it back in the Soviet Union? And all I could think of is how foolish in America that we're squandering our heritage. And in a country where they're seeing a collapse because of the king of greater power that they've ignored for 70 years, they're losing it all. I can only leave you with a very simple message. I know in my own life, as someone who thought he had it all together and got to a position of great power, I never thought I'd be one of the half dozen men sitting around the desk of the President of the United States with all that power and influence. I discovered that there was no restraint on the evil in me, and that in my self-righteousness I was never more dangerous. And I discovered what Solzhenitsyn wrote so brilliantly from a prison, that the line between good and evil passes not between principalities and powers, but it oscillates within the human heart. And that even the most rational approach to ethics is defenseless if there isn't the will to do what is right. And that on my own, and I can only speak for myself, I do not have that will. That which I want to do, I do not do. That which I do not want to do. And it's only when I can turn to the one who, this past weekend we celebrated, was raised from the dead, that I can find the will to do what is right as best I'm able to discern it. And it's only when that value and that sense of righteousness can pervade a society that there can be a moral consensus. And I would hope I might leave with you as future business leaders the thought that the society in which we're a part and in which you have a great sense of, should have a great sense of responsibility and stewardship, desperately today, desperately needs those kind of values. And if I might say so, each one of us do as well. Thank you.